The events, as Ted also said, were necessary to change the psychology of society, and events are moving very fast now. Events are moving with breathtaking speed, both in Britain and particularly on a world scale. Now, if I would have said 12 months ago that you'd have a situation where Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley would all be bankrupt, and that Gordon Brown and George Bush were nationalising the banks, I think, to put it mildly, that the commas would have been a little bit surprised. And it is astonishing. Sometimes events move so fast that you can't even grasp, you can't get your head around what is occurring. What is occurring is an absolute economic, social and political earthquake without parallel since the 1930s. Incidentally, they steadfastly, all the bourgeois and the economists steadfastly denied that there was any possibility of a slump, never mind a deep slump, never mind about the depression, never mind about 1929. Now they all say that the debate now is not whether there's going to be a recession. There is a recession. The debate is whether it's going to be a deep recession or a depression. I don't quite know what the difference is. It's a semantic thing, as far as I can see. But in any case, that's the position. It is a veritable earthquake which is impossible, the consequences of which is impossible to overstate. And by the way, there's a danger here for the older comrades. Sometimes when you repeat and repeat and repeat a certain prediction of a slump and so on, and the perspective is delayed, has been delayed for certain reasons which we will explain in a moment, the danger is that when it actually occurs, comrades are a bit blasé. They don't know what's happening. They don't grasp what's happening. What's happening is the perspective which we've been pointing out for many years. And it's quite amusing in this situation, I can't resist this, it's amusing to see the absolute ridiculous contortions of all the so-called economists, the professional economists. President Truman once said that war is too serious to be left to the generals. I would say economics is too serious to be left to the economists, you see. They're all saying exactly the opposite of what they said for the last 20 or 30 years. It's quite amusing. We're entitled to a little bit of Schadenfreude, as the Germans put it. The bourgeois economists understood nothing and foresaw nothing. It's a fact. It's a simple, empirically verifiable fact. They did not foresee for the last 30 years, they have not made a single correct prediction. They didn't predict any of the slumps. For that matter, they didn't predict the booms either. It's an absolute bankruptcy of these so-called scientific gentlemen. Let's recall, and I think we should rub their noses in it, by the way. They're keeping silent now, stum. They don't like to talk about this anymore. Let's remind ourselves of the NEP, not Lenin's NEP, of course, but the so-called new economic paradigm. Paradigm, as you probably know, is what the scientists say. It's a word they use when they don't know what they're talking about. The new economic paradigm, that there was not supposed to be any more slumps. Well, they said this. This is the received wisdom, expressed, of course, brilliantly by our friend Gordon Brown. He talked about the end of boom and bust. Well, the boom is now well and truly finished, and Britain is well and truly bust. And that's a simple fact. Let's recall also that they talked for 30 years, and they brayed out this nonsense. They were all opposed to regulation. No regulation. That was going to be the secret of success, the philosopher's stone. Deregulation. Markets must be deregulated. Deregulated. You remember this? They made a bonfire of all financial regulation, specifically for the financial sector. We had the so-called Big Bang. When was it? 86? Something like that. 1980s. Now they're all calling for regulation. Regulate, must regulate, must regulate. The argument was the state must not intervene. The state must stay out of it. Laissez-faire. Now Osborne, the Tory vice minister or whatever it is, chancellor, said in the past, and he didn't even blink, he didn't even blush when he said it, He said it in the House of Commons. Laissez-faire is dead. He said this without so much as blinking. The state with the government is not supposed to intervene. Well, now they're pleading for the government to intervene, and they're compelled to allow the government to intervene. I can't resist this quote from the current edition of The Economist, which The Economist could read. I'll show you, just out of interest, just have a look at the covers of the last Economist. I don't have time to read the Financial Times, except occasionally. I've looked at one or two recent, unfortunately. There's a lot of very good stuff in the FT. Just look at the last few Economists. September the 27th, I want your money. Picture of Poulsen. And the subhead is, Will Poulsen's plan work? Next edition, October the 4th. World on the Edge is a picture of a man. I think you can see it standing on more than on the edge of a cliff. He's about to fall off. By the way, inside there's a cartoon of Sarkozy reading Das Kapital. October the 11th, Saving the System. Here's a picture of the world which is collapsing. The world is in free fall. And it says, The Panic, The Rescues, and a Special Report on the World Economy, about which they're justifiably concerned. And last but not least, the current issue, which you may not have seen, I don't know if you can make out the picture, Capitalism at Bay, it says, and there's a picture from an Assyrian frieze, which you find in the British Museum, of a lion being shot to bits by arrows, and it's a moribund lion. The editorial of this current edition says the following, I quote, In the short term, they don't define the terms, in the short term, defending capitalism means, paradoxically, state intervention. This is The Economist, which for the last 20 or 30 years has been conducting a loud campaign, a noisy campaign against this. And then they console themselves with the following winged phrases. And capitalism, eventually, they never define the time span, and capitalism eventually corrects itself. After a crisis, it says, investors seldom make the same mistake twice. Like a drunken man after a wild party, saying that you never drink, you've signed the pledge, I'll never do this again. They always say the same thing after every crisis, and then they proceed to repeat precisely the same mistakes as what they've done in the past. Capitalism eventually corrects itself, it says. Of course, Keynes had the perfect answer to that, which you all remember. In the long run, said Keynes, we're all dead. And of course, the question is, they argue now about a correction, thinking that the word correction sounds a bit more decent than a slump or a recession or anything like that. A correction, you say. Well, I suppose in a sense it is a correction. It will be a very severe correction because of the severe distortions which they introduced in the last period. What they don't say is that a correction under these circumstances will have the most severe consequences, and that's what we must do. We must keep your eye on the ball. It's okay to discuss the theory of economics, which you must do, of course, but you must see the effects of it. That's the point. The effect in consciousness. Human consciousness, we explain many times in terms of Marxist dialectical materialism, is not a progressive thing. It lags behind events that, under normal circumstances. That's the case. Human consciousness, I think this goes back to very primitive times, the remnant of a primitive psychology. People don't like change. People in general do not like change. They cling to the old traditional ideas, habits, familiar political parties, institutions, and so on. They don't normally question these institutions. They're accustomed to them. This is like a self-defense, psychological self-defense mechanism. Yes, that's normally the case. But there are certain circumstances. This is pure dialectics. You can have many years where things go ticking along quite nicely. Then suddenly society reaches a critical point, to use an expression of the physicists, in which things turn into their opposite. Now that's what we must grasp. Things, everything turns in its opposite. I'll try to demonstrate in the course of the reader how economically things have turned into the opposite. But more important for us, 1,000 times more important, is how the consciousness of the working class, and not just the working class, the bourgeois, the middle class, also turn into its opposite. On the basis of the hammer blows of events. You get a jolt. The jolt might be a war, as happened in 1914. Or it might be an economic catastrophe, because this is an economic catastrophe. a very serious state of affairs. Also jolts people out of the complacency, out of the apathy. The old apathy is gone now. Everyone's discussing. People that didn't discuss politics or economics took no interest in the workings of the stock exchange. It all seemed a bit arcane. And now you have in every bus stop, in every marketplace, in the barber shop, wherever, in the pub, what are people talking about? They're talking about this. That in itself is a fundamental change in the situation which this tendency must take on board. Oh, then of course we have our Gordon, the hero of the hour, Gordon Brown. I was just thinking, there's a phrase in Bertolt Brecht's play The Life of Galileo where Andreas said, unhappy is the land that has no heroes, and Galileo says, no, unhappy is the land that needs heroes. And by God, triply unhappy is a land that's got to have a hero like Gordon Brown, for God's sake. A most unlikely knight in shining armour, who's now being compared to Churchill and Roosevelt and the Dunkirk spirit and his finest hour, and so on and so forth. We see how long this will last. From zero to hero, they said. Well, it will soon be from hero to zero when it becomes evident that all the so-called solutions of Brown are no solutions at all. Although apparently it's very popular in Europe at the moment. And hitherto, they didn't like to listen to Brown. He's such a boring speaker. And didn't often turn up to meetings, but then he left early anyway. It was treated like everyone else, was treated with a figure of contempt. Now I think that no old age Testament prophet has been listened to with such rapt attention as Gordon Brown has got the soul. I suppose when you've got no ideas of your own, anyone that seems to have half an idea, obviously somebody can listen. What are the ideas of Brown for solving the banking problem? Point number one, transparency. Yes, the world capitalist financial system is as transparent as a cesspool. Second, integrity. The bankers must now have integrity. They're about as they have as much integrity as a mafia convention. And responsibility. They must be responsible. They never have been responsible in the past, but they must be responsible now. Not as responsible as the lapsed members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Empty words. And these empty words are put up as a brilliant solution. Of course, and throwing tons of money. You know, since the banks are essential to the capitalist system, you throw tons of money at them. We'll come to the amount of money in a moment. Throw tons of money and the bankers will be happy and then they will invest. And then they will start lending to each other and then the problem will be solved. Even Lula then, this is everywhere. Lula in Brazil says the same thing. He says that we need to combat the anarchy of capitalism. He's just woken up to the fact that capitalism is anarchic. Yes, but none of these gentlemen say how. How these things are going to be. The real reason, we must remember this, the real reason for capitalist crisis was explained, not even in Capital, was explained in the Communist Manifesto, where Marx explains, the conditions of bourgeois society are too narrow to comprise the wealth created by them. By God, that is certainly the case at the moment. Marx also explains, even in the Manifesto, that the capitalist can get round crisis, can postpone crisis more accurately, but only at the cost of preparing deeper crises in the future, which is precisely what has occurred. How do they get round the crisis? Well, there's different means. One of the main things is the increased intensification of the world division of labour, increased participation on world markets, which has taken place in a massive sense over the last 20 years, particularly since the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, it cannot be a matter of indifference that thousands of millions, about 2 billion people in Russia, China, Eastern Europe joined the world capitalist. India also was drawn into the world capitalist economy. And this undoubtedly gave them a boost. Ted explained that the reason why there have been crises, by the way, there was a crisis in 90 and 91, and there was another one, was it 2001, I think, the dot-com crisis. And the reason why particularly the 1990-1991 crisis, which we expected would be a full-blown crisis, that it didn't develop into a deep crisis, there was a crisis, but it wasn't a deep recession, was mainly because of the growth of Asia, China, and so on and so forth, which is still going forward. Yes, but you see, the argument, which is the basis of the NEP, the New Economic Paradigm, that crises, therefore, were not possible, assumes that capitalism had solved its fundamental contradictions. It did not. All that has happened with globalization, which has had a big effect, there's no argument about that, opening up new markets, fields of investment, and so on and so forth. But all that it's done is to reproduce the contradictions of capitalism on a far vaster scale that's ever been seen at this time. Never been seen before. And that's the point. This process of globalization now is reaching its limits. To call a spade a shovel, the fundamental contradictions, the fundamental barriers of human progress are two things. Private ownership of the means of production. By the way, in so many words, they're forced to admit that when they resort to the state. A nationalisation even they make, it's a tacit admission that the private enterprise system, the private ownership has failed, that they cannot even control their own economic system. And secondly, of course, mustn't forget this, the global economy, the national economy, rather. Private ownership and the national state are the two main obstacles in relation to growth. They partially overcame the latter by means of globalization. Now this it's reached its limits. It's clearly reached its limits, and therefore globalization manifests itself as a global crisis of capitalism. One has to be a blind man not to understand that. Of course, the bourgeois can't admit this. How can they admit it? How can the economists admit this? Lenin said that a man on the edge of a cliff does not reason, and they're not capable of reasoning. They seek superficial explanations, as always. It's confidence. Confidence has disappeared, and therefore, as long as you restore confidence, everything will be rosy in the garden. What they don't understand is that this famous confidence reflects objective processes in the economy. The second argument is that it's credit. They always put this, in every crisis, they put this idea forward. That credit is, that crises are a reflection of the expansion and contraction of credit. Whereas in reality, as Marx explained, the expansion and contraction of credit is only a symptom of the crisis. The latest argument they put forward is it's a problem of liquidity. It's not enough money. Why there should be not enough money after all the billions and trillions they've made the last 20 or 30 years, I'll leave it to you to work out. But it's a problem of liquidity. And therefore, if you accept it's a problem of it, Marx explains that it's not the shortage of money that causes a crisis, but it's a crisis that causes the shortage of money. It's quite clear. But if you accept this bum argument of the economists, well, the solution is simple. You just throw money. You throw sufficient money at the banks. Everything will be solved. Now, they're just thrown, in case you hadn't noticed, the latest figure that I can remember, perhaps other economists will have got more up-to-date figures, they've just thrown $2.5 trillion at the banks. Has it prevented the crisis? It is not. It's still going down. And the reason that the stock exchanges are still going down, of the entire world, by the way, I'll try and give some figures if I have time, is very simple. The bourgeois understand what we understood for some time. Incidentally, the banking crisis is not the crisis. It's only a prelude. It's only a prelude to the real crisis, which is the crisis of the real economy. Of course, the two are connected, but it's not the cause of the crisis. I've got some interesting quotes from Marx from the correspondence that, with your permission, if I can find them, I'm just going through the correspondence for 1857. And if I can find. Yes, he says, Marx says the following, letter to Engels on the 8th of December. He said, the next few days would see the farce of suspension of the Bank Act. But that not too much should be made of this monetary panic, the real affair being the impending industrial crash. That's the point. And he goes on to explain this in some detail. It's quite interesting, the parallel. He says, it's nice to, says Marx, that the capitalists who so vociferously opposed the right to work are now everywhere demanding public support from their government and hence advocating the right to profit at public expense. You see, things don't change very much, do they, in over 100 years. He says, just now people here are deluding themselves into thinking that the crisis is over, because the first phase, the monetary crisis, with its immediate consequences, is over. And so then he explains, of course, that's not the case. The real crisis, of course, must be in the real economy. That's it, the productive process, factories, and so on and so forth. We'll deal with that in a moment. Therefore, when we say that this crisis began as a financial crisis of the banks in August 2007 with the subprime crisis, we're saying nothing new. Believe me, there's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new. This always happens like that. What is perhaps new about this is the scale of it. Not the thing itself, but the colossal, the vast, unimaginable scale of this crisis, which compelled the bourgeois very early on to intervene. The state had to intervene, including in America. Yes. By the way, that when they intervened, it still wasn't clear that there was actually a recession in America, although the economy was slowing down. It's important to note. The economy was slowing down before the major crisis broke. And what this indicates, this massive intervention of the state, which was not unprecedented since the 30s, it's a fact, since the New Deal, this massive intervention indicates what? The word panic conveys it quite accurately. It indicates fear, a deep-rooted fear, not just of the economic perspective, but of the social and political consequences, which compelled them to take extraordinary measures. For example, the nationalization, de facto, that's what it is. The nationalization of the two giant mortgage firms, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, followed by the taking over of AIG, which I think is the biggest insurance company in the world. The American government at that time extended deposit insurance to the amount of $3.5 trillion. That's for starters. That's for opening. Plus, of course, as you remember, they spent $700 billion of American taxpayers' money in order to purchase what? In order to purchase rubbish, what they call toxic mortgage assets. We've explained the nature of these assets in the past. I don't intend to repeat it. Now, Marx explains that credit is merely a means. There's nothing magical about credit. Credit is a means whereby the capitalist can expand the market for a temporary period beyond its natural limits. I think that's a perfectly plain, clear thing. The trouble is, of course, that if you extend this, all you're doing is extending the market in demand in the short term at the cost of undermining it drastically in the long term, which is precisely what they've done. There's now an unprecedented, as a result of this policy, as a result of these tactics, there's now an unprecedented level of indebtedness, and at the same time an unprecedented levels of speculation. There's speculation in every boom. You find speculation in every boom in history, starting with the 17th century, the Dutch tulip speculative boom. Yes, but it's the scale of it that's unprecedented. It's absolutely eye-watering. It's absolutely staggering. The housing boom in America, and not just in America, but to take America, was the biggest speculative bubble in history. I've seen the figures, I haven't got them with me, but it dwarfs the speculation that preceded the Wall Street crash of 1929. By the way, John Galbraith's book is a bestseller now. 1929. Everyone is reading this now. An event which was never supposed to take place again. I know they're all studying it and studying also Das Kapital, which is said is a bestseller in Germany. Karl Marx's Capital is a bestseller to the astonishment of the publisher, and that's not an accident. This bubble, this immense bubble, is a means of prolonging the boom by artificial means, has now burst. As every speculative This bubble has burst, as speculative booms always burst. The U.S. house prices, the last figure I've seen, they've fallen by 20%. But that's not enough. They must fall further because they rose further. In other words, they have to compensate now. They must compensate. That's what a correction means. It's got a certain amount of logic, twisted logic to it. That's what they must do. They've fallen by 20%. They must fall still further. Some economists said By at least 10%, but it might be more. Who can say? The fact of the matter is, nobody knows. That's the point. They're in uncharted waters. They've never been in a situation like this before. And it's a little bit analogous to an avalanche. Now, an avalanche has got its own dynamics. Some avalanches start, and the snow just reaches a certain point and stops. Or it might go a little bit further, and it stops again. But sooner or later, you pile up enough snow, and the avalanche will become unstoppable. That's what they're afraid of. They realize, they know, that they've piled up all this colossal amount of fictitious capital in the last period, which must now be squeezed out of the organism. And unfortunately, talk about the correction. Correction sounds very nice. But the problem is that this correction can get out of control. They won't be able to control it, which is why they're trying desperately to pump money into the economy, which is not working, by the way. It's not working. According to the IMF, worldwide losses on debts from the just only from the subprime crisis in the US alone, there's other debts, of course, amount to $1.4 trillion, which is two times more. It's twice as much as what they said in April. In other words, they don't know. Nobody knows the amount of so-called toxic debt, which is just what you see is the tip of the iceberg. The banks alone have so far reported, but that's just nonsense, $600 billion. And therefore, what seems to us to be colossal amounts of money which is being dished into the banking system, really speaking, will not meet the bill. Will not solve the problem.